Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the show, Mitt Romney's stance on immigration, Governor Gary Herbert's public opposition to a medical marijuana initiative, last weekend's demonstrations for and against gun control, and more. Joining me to talk about these stories, Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry. Welcome, Dan.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. Government reporter Courtney Tanner is here in studio with us as well. And good morning, Courtney.
Good morning.
And on the phone, we've got Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Hello, Tommy, and good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Listeners, you can weigh in on the stories that we are covering today. Post your questions and comments at sltrib.com or at the KCPW Facebook page. Thomas Burr, this week, Mitt Romney made a couple of statements about immigration that that garnered some headlines. He was talking about Dreamers. These are the people who were brought to the U.S. as children, brought here by their parents, that is. And this caught a couple of people off guard, Romney's statements, that is, did, because of the contrast that it drew against some other statements that Romney has made. Tommy, what was it that Mitt said on this topic and in what context?
Yeah, let's start from the beginning and go forward because it makes sense when you kind of look at what he said when he announced his campaign in February, which was that Utah welcomes legal immigrants from around the world and, quote, Washington sends immigrants a message of exclusion. And then this event in Utah County this week, Romney told a conservative audience, well, he's more of a hawk in immigration, that the Dreamers, the DACA kids, shouldn't be allowed to stay in the country legally. And so that kind of, you know, goes against, it seems like, what he was saying before. Romney's clarifying now, essentially trying to say, look, what I'm saying is when I was running for president in 2012, I was against giving, you know, any legal status to the Dreamers. But that's essentially moot now because President Barack Obama, when he was in office, enacted some executive actions to protect the kids from being deported, give them some kind of status. So now he's saying, you know, well, we've got to move forward. If they want to have a permanent residency, they need to do something. They need to serve in the military. They need to be attending college. They need to be a school teacher, do something to kind of give back to society.
The message, I mean, again, you pointed out the what Romney said in a video that he released last month when he, or a couple of months ago when he announced his Senate bid. And what he said then does contrast again against what he said just this week. He said that Utah is not like what the president does. You know, we're welcoming to immigrants here. And then in Utah County at this, I guess he made these comments at, Tommy, where did he make these comments again?
Utah Republican Women, I think, was the
venue. Okay, in front of the Utah Republican.
Dan Harry for the save there. Thank you, Dan.
Exactly. But he says that he's more of a hawk on immigration than the president. I guess the question that I have, and maybe this is more of a question for Paul Raleigh, who is joining us in studio right now, Salt Lake Tribune columnist, is this about politics? I mean, is he doing this because of a need to distinguish himself on immigration, Paul?
Well, let me say it this way. It looks like we've got the same old Mitt. He seems to be picking up where he left off from his when he ran for president in his last, you know, past political forays. He seems to have a knack for shaping his policy positions to fit whatever group he happens to be wanting to get favor from at the time. You know, he's speaking to a very conservative group. He's going to gather signatures, but he's also going to go through the convention. And he's also very, right now, very active in getting delegate lists and reaching out to delegates. And he might be the first candidate for the U.S. Senate to have started doing all that. And so the delegates, as we all know, are generally much more conservative, and in particular, convention delegates have fought back against legislative efforts to give any kind of, pathway to a work permit or anything else for immigrants. So he was speaking to that group.
Okay.
He's already under attack a little bit by some of the right-wing elements among the delegates community. And he, the Davis County Republican chair sent out an email to all the delegates blasting Romney for getting the delegate list before they were ready to sent it out, and she called that illegal. So he's I think he's just currying favor now to the right-wing group that he happened to be speaking to at the moment.
And who he may have offended, as you said, with this delegate list. Tommy, I just want to talk about the comments that he made. Did he walk back those comments? I know he was kind of asked about his seemingly more hardline stance on immigration. Did he you know, sort of stray away from that? Did he double down on it? Has he addressed it since he made those comments?
Let's put it this way. They tried to clarify by sending out the actual transcript of what he said, because the first reports we got from the Daily Herald, which was great, and they did a good story. The campaign said, well, look at the full quote. Look at absolutely what he said. And tried to clarify that when he was talking about when he was against the Dreamers getting legal status, that was in 2012. That was a while back, and that was when he was a candidate for president. Obama obviously won that race, and it took some action. So he's saying things have changed, that the circumstances are different. So I wouldn't say they walked it back or doubled down. It was more of, hey, this is what we're really trying to say.
It sounds a little bit confusing. Maybe Dan Harry, Tribune government editor, does Romney need to do this? He seems like the presumptive candidate almost from the Republican side. Maybe that's putting too much on it, actually.
Yeah, I'm not sure why he's doing it. I mean, I think that he's pretty well got the nomination locked up, if not through the convention by signatures. And my guess is he'd probably win at both in both venues. But, you know, I don't know why he started talking about his position in 2012. So there is a lot of confusion around his comments, and I don't know why you start by talking about where you were when you're at a different place now. So, you know, all the confusion is his fault. I mean, you know, he should talk about what his stand is now, not about where it was when it was 2012. So the confusion is understandable. And then the other day, after the appearance in Provo, he was talking to delegates, and he was talking more about his immigration policy, not the Dreamers, but those folks who are coming in. And he talked about now he wants a merit-based system, so you would get points based on, like, English literacy or how much savings you had, so you'd have money to live and invest when you got here. And he kind of laid out, at least in a skeletal form, this what would be a very different kind of immigration system from what we have. And, you know, that's the first that we had heard of that. He pointed us back to his campaign website, and that's what it says, but it doesn't flesh it out very much.
Well, this is also an idea that the president is behind, the idea of a merit-based immigration system. And I'm just going to go back to Paul Raleigh here for the editorial commentary. I've heard hope expressed from some political commentators that Romney play the role of a Jeff Flake or somebody who takes an opposing role to Trump in the Senate. But Romney appears to be somewhat in line with what the president's thinking is on immigration. What should we make of that, Paul?
Well, I don't want to sound too much like a cynic, but like I said, this is the same old Mitt. He looks at the political wins, and Trump right now is among the Republican base in Utah is relatively popular, and so I don't think he's going to be a Jeff Flake. He's not going to. Jeff Flake decided not to run because he was going to lose because he's got Trump's ire, and so the Trump people now are behind him. Romney has never, in my observations, shown that kind of political courage. He'll go along with what he thinks is going to play the best for the Republican base, and right now it's to agree with Trump to get a little harder on the immigration policies.
I think we just lost Tommy Bird there. Dan Harry, I know that Democratic candidate Jenny Wilson, who's one of actually four Democrats in this race, took a swipe at Romney for what she kind of referred to as well as political speak. What did she have to say about what he said?
Well, she pointed out that, you know, what he had said recently in his remarks were very different from what his campaign opening video said, which was immigrants are welcome here. And she kind of talked about how that isn't the Utah way, that Utah, for the most part, welcomes immigration. We have tried to pass laws that are more friendly to immigrants than some of our neighbors, particularly Arizona. So she was trying to draw a strong contrast there with between her and Mitt on immigration.
I know that she called, again, speaking to the clarity of statements, you mentioned what he had said back in 2012 versus what he said now, maybe sowing confusion, or at least the result was some confusion being sold. She called it gobbledygook, from what I understand, which was kind of an amazing statement to make. And she also took issue with these comments on merit-based immigration, as you said, Dan.
Right, okay. Right.
Well, can I just say that I had a hard time figuring out how to spell gobbledygook. That was not an easy thing.
But it's a great word.
It is a great word. Thomas Burr, I know that we have just a couple of minutes left with you, and we lost you for a second there, but I want to also dip into a story that you reported that appears in this morning's paper, and that is that the U.S. Attorney for Utah, John Huber, has been conducting an investigation into the FBI's surveillance of a Trump aide, of a former Trump aide, that is, and into whether the agency didn't dig deeply enough into the sale of U.S. uranium rights to a Russian company. Can you explain this to us? At whose behest is the U.S. Attorney for Utah, John Huber, doing this?
Yeah, so the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, has asked Huber to do this, and it looks like he's been doing this since about at least November of last year that we know of. And this all kind of stems from several Republicans, including the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, the Senate Judiciary Committee, the Oversight and Government Reform Committee, who are concerned that, hey, we've got this special counsel investigating, you know, Trump and Russia and their possible collusion. What about Hillary Clinton? Why aren't we investigating Hillary Clinton? It's kind of an extension of, you know, they're still not over the emails, the situation with their private server. They think that there was something a little off with the idea that, you know, this Clinton Foundation was getting money from this guy who ended up working for a company. The Uranium One thing is a very long, complicated thing. There's a lot of fact checkers that have shown that, like, there's nothing there. But essentially, the Republicans are concerned that we're not looking at Hillary enough, and that Carter Page, a Trump aide, was illegally surveilled based off some bad information given to a federal court. So essentially, Sessions is saying, well, I'm not sure I'm going to go with a special counsel. Let me ask the U.S. Attorney for Utah, who's outside of Washington, to take a look at this.
And, you know, these are both things that that President Trump has complained about, the wiretap of Carter Page after his trip to Russia. And then this uranium deal. Do we know any of what Huber, I'm not certain how to pronounce it, his review has turned up, Tommy?
I just keep calling him the U.S. attorney because I can't pronounce his name either. You know, we don't know yet. I mean, we didn't even know until yesterday that he was involved in this at all. And I don't know when we're going to see any kind of reporting back on what he has found. This is, though, and critics will tell you pretty quickly that they believe this is essentially another effort to distract from the Mueller investigation into Russia and Trump's team, that this is trying to muddy the waters, confuse voters, that there's really, you know, these things have been investigated ad nauseum, but yet the Republicans are not giving up because it's a good way to say, look over here, this shiny object, not this shiny object over here.
Dan Harry.
There's also some indication, though it's not crystal clear, that his investigation is going much broader into things such as the Clinton campaign funding of the so-called dossier investigation, that was partly relied upon to get some FISA warrants in the Mueller investigation. The Congress members had asked Sessions to make sure that's included, that alleged leaks by former FBI Director James Comey were investigated. So we're not sure how broad this investigation is, but it could open up the whole closet of allegations that Republicans have used to try to say, why are you focusing on Russia meddling in the election and allegations of collaboration with the Trump campaign? Look at all this other stuff over there. And so, you know, how far this has gone and what's been turned up yet, we don't have a clue yet.
Can I just add real fast?
Sure, Tommy.
I think there were 14 items that the Republicans in a letter last year said they wanted looked at. So like Dan was saying, it's a litany of items. Let's also remind our listeners here that Huber was an Obama appointee, actually, in 2015. He did resign as asked by Trump when he came into office, and then Trump reappointed him. So he's been appointed by Obama and Trump.
And the way it works here in Utah and has for many years is really it's the two senators who are kind of deciding who the U.S. attorney is going to be. The president, Democrat or Republican, has kind of gone along with their suggestions. So Orrin Hatch and Mike Lee were very high on Huber, and I think that's why he got the job.
Both from Obama appointment and from the Trump appointment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Paul Raleigh, any thoughts on this before we head to a break on the investigation or the review that that the U.S. attorney for Utah is conducting?
Well, I sort of feel sorry for John Huber. From what I know of him, he's a real stand-up guy. He's got a lot of integrity, and now all of a sudden he's stuck in the middle of all this political, game playing and everything else. I mean, this is just. I mean, he's doing what his boss is asking him to do and everything else. But this is just a continuation. I mean, we've heard now for a long time on Fox News and other right-wing outlets that the FBI's dirty, the CIA's dirty. They're all out to get Trump. This is the biggest scandal in the history of the United States and everything else. And they keep saying it and saying it and saying it, so eventually it'll sound like it's true. And I think that Jeff Sessions is just—he's trying to appease Trump, and he's trying to appease the Republican elements in Congress, and so he's walking a fine line.
Tommy, just that there's a strained relationship between Jeff Sessions and President Trump, or there has been through the months. But just going back to this review that John Huber's conducting, before we let you go, some of this has been vetted before, right? I mean, not by a federal attorney, but by, organizations that have looked into this.
Well, all of this has been vetted before. None of these allegations are new, and I think you can look up, if you want to know about these things, just Google it pretty quickly. The Uranium One deal, for example, has really been examined by the FBI. If you look at, fact checkers out there have looked at this. It's a long, complicated thing, but in the essence, Hillary Clinton was one of nine, secretaries that had to sign off on this deal, plus the Federal Regulatory Commission. So none of these are necessarily are going to yield maybe much results unless Huber can find that the FBI totally was in the can for her. But I don't know that's the case. So it will be interesting to see what he finds. Sessions is trying to walk that line, like we were just talking about, that he's got to make Trump happy so he doesn't get fired, but he doesn't want to go too far with it. Mm.
Well, and the take of most of the national reporting on this story yesterday was the fact that Jeff Sessions refused to appoint a special counsel to look into these things. So a special counsel would have much broader authority and much more resources than a U.S. attorney from Utah would. So they took that as a sign that, yes, Sessions is trying to appease the Republican pressure to do this, but he's not going all in on it.
That's an interesting point. Guys, it is time for our first break of the show. Thomas Burr, Salt Lake Tribune, Washington Bureau Chief, I know you've got to run, but thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
When we come back, we will turn to the student-led march against gun violence and the march by gun rights advocates that preceded it. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more of our in-house podcasts, visit kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Courtney Tanner, government editor Dan Harry, and columnist Paul Raleigh. It is our Friday morning local news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by posting them to sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. Courtney Tanner, this past weekend there was a march that came together like many other marches around the country in the wake of the school shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida. This was a student-led march against gun violence, and there are other aspects of this that we'll get into in just a moment. But first, I want to ask, for people who weren't there, What did this march look like? Was it mostly kids? Can you kind of describe it for us?
Sure. Maybe the biggest impression I can give you is just how large it was. Mm-hmm. I've covered other rallies at the Capitol. This one blows all of those out of the water. Oh. There were people still marching up the street 15 minutes into the program that these students were leading. So it was just massive. It spanned blocks.
Okay, so the program started, people were speaking, and students or people who were marching were still coming up the street.
That's
from the
right.
There was this other protest as well, which came together after the first march was launched. And this was a march by gun advocates, and they called it March Before Our Lives. The student-led protest was called March For Our Lives. This one was called March Before Our Lives. Describe that for us. This was happening at the same time as the student march, and just tell us what that scene looked like.
Sure. So the pro-gun rally kicked off about 2 hours before the student-led rally. There was obviously some tensions between the ideologies there. The pro-gun rally was pretty interesting. There were 1,000 people there, and a lot of them were carrying guns. You know, some had assault rifles slung over their back. Some, you know, just had like a pistol holstered to their waist. Just a lot of people wearing black shirts. It was pretty big as well.
Hmm. What was the purpose of their march as opposed to and why was it a separate march then? I mean, I guess it, in some ways it makes sense, but explain to us how that came together.
The pro-gun group said that they felt excluded from the student-led march, but they wanted to come out and say, we defend the Second Amendment, but we all want the same thing. We all want to keep students safe in schools.
Okay. Did these two groups interact, the students and the pro-gun marchers?
For the most part, it was pretty peaceful, which I think surprised a lot of people given all the firepower there. There was kind of a little tussle when the pro-gun group started and passed West High School where the students were gathering. There was kind of a fence between them. Some words were shouted between them, but mostly peaceful.
And the organizers of this student-led march, they had a pretty straightforward message, which was act, and act specifically to change gun policy. Can you talk about the changes that they were recommending that they want to see, you know, enacted?
Their big message was, you know, we don't want prayers anymore. We want policy. The biggest things that they kind of demanded, I guess, were a ban on military-grade weapons. They wanted expanded background checks, and they want a mandatory waiting period between when you can purchase and pick up a gun.
Okay, and those are the same changes that were advocated in other marches and by students from the high school in Florida, from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. Paul Raleigh, Salt Lake Tribune columnist, I want to bring you in on this and first talk about the activism that we're seeing here by students in Utah and around the country. These are kids, they're teenagers, and in some instances younger than teenagers, who are leading this discussion. What does that mean for the conversation about school shootings and gun violence in America?
Well, I think it's very significant, and these kids are really making a difference. And I think that this is the most significant nationwide massive protest that we've seen since the Vietnam War. And I'm old enough to remember the Vietnam protests and that sort of thing. And,
sure.
and you know, mostly in the colleges, college students, and they made a difference. They really did. And I think we're seeing that happen now. And I think some of the NRA advocates and people like that are afraid of these kids because they're seeing what kind of impact they had and have. And you've seen some of the pushbacks that they're trying to do. And I mean, it's almost been kind of ugly to see some of these, you know, pundits who are trying to discredit these kids, trying to, you know, calling them, you know, paid actors. And I mean, which is incredibly offensive. And I think it's not helping the pundits to do that. I mean, it's just making people—it's making them look pretty bad. We just—what was it, yesterday or the day before? Laura Ingraham of Fox News went after one of the kids from the Florida high school, saying that, you know, he didn't get accepted to four different universities, and so somehow that makes him a bad student. The kid's got a 4.2 grade point average, and I mean, the ones he didn't get accepted to are like Harvard, and I mean, which, you know, hardly anybody gets accepted to. But there's been now a big, in fact, I think we're seeing corporate America now step up. And when she did that, my understanding is that a lot of corporations pulled their advertising off of Fox in protest to what she did. I had a column earlier this week about some dirty tricks.
Yeah, this was interesting. I mean, you wrote about this attempt to sabotage the student march here in Utah, not the national march, but actually here in Utah. And this was online. And whoever did this kind of took a tactic out of the Russian election meddling handbook.
Right.
This is sort of an interesting side note. Tell us what happened here, Paul.
Well, the march, I believe, Courtney, was set for 11 o'clock, right, a.m. Mm-hmm. on Saturday. So Saturday morning, and it was called March for Our Lives, Salt Lake City. And all of a sudden, this page came up online called March for Our Lives in Salt Lake City. And it basically said, you know, we've been down, we've lost everything, but we're back up and we just want to, you know, make sure you come to the rally at 3:30 p.m. Hmm. So it was a deliberate attempt to confuse people so they would go at the wrong time and wouldn't show up to the 11 o'clock real rally.
It is. I mean, it's an interesting tactic to try and, you know, confuse people. Dan Harry.
It didn't work,
though. It didn't work.
Yeah. No, it did not
work. The police estimated there were 8,000 people in the March for Our Lives rally.
Paul Raleigh talked about this being kind of almost like, you know, Vietnam moratorium, like a mass protest that happened around the country. A referendum on what's happening with gun violence in America. Courtney, a question that I have for you is, will this translate into political action? Did students talk about carrying the momentum that they have to, say, the ballot boxes?
I think we'll see this continue. I think these kids are activated and ready and energized. They were signing up to vote at the rallies, so.
Paul Raleigh, any comments on this before we move on to other topics, the sort of the new political front that is young people in America?
Well, yeah, it's finally taken. I mean, I think, you know, the Parkland shooting was just that's tipped this thing over the edge. Mm-hmm. I think and it's really caught on. And it's like Vietnam did after Vietnam went on for a few years, and finally you had all these student activists and everything, and it became a major, mm-hmm. massive, nationwide movement. And I think we're seeing the same thing now. I think that, and especially when you have the pushback against these kids and these groups trying to discredit them and trying to smear them. It's gonna make it grow. It's gonna make them look better and better, and the people trying to smear them look worse and worse.
Courtney Tanner, I don't know if this is a question you can answer, but students around the country, and I believe here in Utah, have also been trying to organize some town halls with elected officials. Do we know much about that from the local level? Do you have a sort of line on that at all?
I haven't heard much about them, but it doesn't surprise me. I mean, I just have to say, you know, they filled the Capitol steps. I mean, there wasn't an empty spot. So I think that they have a lot of power behind this.
And compared to, like, air quality rallies or the Women's March, I mean, that is sizable or more larger?
Yeah. The biggest one that I covered was the Refugee March, which was also huge. But this one, I think, still vastly outnumbered.
And like I mentioned earlier, you see all the signs. I believe that the NRA and their supporters are scared to death of these kids.
Hmm. Well, I'm sure this is not the last we'll hear from the kids, and it's weird to be talking about them. They led this movement, and we will see what happens next. Courtney Tanner, thanks very much for this reporting. Dan Harry, government editor, I want to turn to some of the sort of remnants of this past legislative session. And during the session, lawmakers passed measures to allow for a limited amount of medical marijuana use in Utah. The governor has now signed that package of bills. At the same time, though, he said, essentially, we're all good here. This is as far as we need to go for now. Tell us about his caveat as he made this decision, Dan.
Yeah, so he had signed those bills and really didn't comment on the time. But yesterday he released a statement saying that he was opposed to the initiative and that it was dangerous in that it would, he believed, open the door to recreational marijuana. And he said he will actively oppose the initiative. But the sponsors of that initiative, which is a pretty broad-based legalization of medical marijuana for a long list of ailments and maladies and suffering, to relieve pain and suffering, They say they're almost got enough signatures to get on the ballot. And according to polls, it's a pretty popular proposition.
What the governor signed is, as we said, limited and limited.
Very limited.
In that it gives medical marijuana as an option, a sort of right to try almost, as people have 6 months or less to
right.
live. Is that right?
So only terminal patients with 6 months or less to okay. live. That's so you can see how limited that is. A lot of the folks that have been lobbying for a few years at the Capitol have come up and, you know, they have different diseases. They have different pain and suffering left over, for instance, from injuries. None of those people would be allowed to use the medical marijuana under this legislation.
Is there, I mean, again, you said the governor in this statement yesterday, he talks about the initiative being potentially opening the door, the initiative that is waiting in the wings, mm-hmm. potentially opening up mm-hmm. the door to recreational use.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a line to be drawn there between those two things? I mean, if we look at the initiative, does it appear to have a back door to recreational use? I guess it would come down to doctors.
Yeah, there's nothing in the initiative that would allow that. I mean, it's specified as a medical treatment that would be prescribed by doctors. So there's nothing that in the initiative itself that would lead to that. I think the governor's looking at maybe some other states where what began as legal medical marijuana now has turned into full bore recreational marijuana. And you can look at some of our neighbors for that. Colorado and Nevada both are among those groups that started off with medical marijuana.
I'm curious. You know, there's also I know that some backers of the initiative have been pointing to the opioid crisis as sort of another reason for potentially backing medical marijuana because it could be used to alleviate pain is the idea, and that would get people off of addictive opioids.
Right. That's one of their arguments is that opioids are overprescribed for pain and different kinds of. Post-surgical trauma. And so that this would be something, and especially in chronic pain cases, the medical marijuana might be something that would alleviate the pressure on physicians prescribing those more dangerous and addictive drugs.
Does Dan, when the governor says that he will actively oppose this initiative, he can't stop them from getting signatures to get on the ballot. I guess he means trying to convince voters to reject the initiative once it's there.
Yeah, we don't know exactly what he means by that, but you could envision, I think, him cutting maybe some ads. They use now a lot of robocalls where they'll tape a prominent person's voice and send them out to registered voters. So you could see that kind of thing.
Paul Raleigh, during the legislative session, we talked about lawmakers not liking it when, you know, the people through initiative processes are taking direct action to write laws. The governor, at least in this instance, seems to agree with lawmakers on that point. Could his opposition play a key role in thwarting this thing at the ballot box?
Well, it may. I mean, you know, he's still got he's a popular governor. He's still got a high approval rating, and so he may have a say. I mean, we see this all the time that when people start citizens' initiatives, the legislature always hates it, and they are always trying to do different things to thwart it. And we've seen this on several issues where an citizens' initiative will begin. And then the legislature will pass a very limited version, or at least talk about it, that doesn't go nearly as far as the initiative would go. But then they can say, "See, we don't need the initiative now because we've passed this bill, or we've passed this law and everything else." And I mean, that's what that count my vote compromise was all about. And now you've got that initiative that would have. Given what is it, Dan, $700 million
right.
to education. And so
our schools now.
Yeah, so the legislature, has reached a compromise with them to get, for a more limited amount of money. But and then over the years, we've seen the legislature tweak the law to make it more and more difficult to get the ballot initiative on the ballot.
Some of those efforts have failed, though. I mean, they've tried to do that. They've tried to even do away with initiatives at one point. That voters obviously don't like that. In one way or another, though, these initiatives are driving the conversation. Whether or not they're, you know, they themselves are getting turned into law, they are making, they're forcing the legislature to act, right?
Well, you've seen the on the Count My Vote initiative. Now now the people who are opposed to that, who want to just keep the caucus convention system rather than having a signature gathering, they've decided to fight fire with fire, and they've got their own initiative going, you know, the Count My Voice or something like that.
Keep My Voice, yeah.
And Keep My Voice. And they're very aggressive. I've been hit up by those people a few times.
For signatures.
Yeah, and they're more aggressive than any other initiative, people passing initiative petitions around that I've ever encountered.
Dan Harry? I think it's allergy season here. It's causing a lot of coughing. But the question that I have for you, Dan, is about that same driver of the conversation of policymaking from the citizen initiative level. And you're right. Paul Raleigh points out the fact that you've got now various sides using that method to try and convince people.
Right. And you saw the legislative session was very much driven by the initiatives. We have, I think, at one point, 6 or 7 out there. And a lot of what the legislature talked about was driven by those initiatives out there. And very much they are trying to, number one, reach a compromise with the groups, as they did with Our Schools Now, or number two, try to pass something much more limited and then point to it as the governor's doing now and saying, what we've done is sufficient. We shouldn't go farther than that, so defeat the initiative.
My favorite example was back in the 1990s, Merrill Cook got an initiative drive going that it was a term limits, and it would limit the terms of most elected officials to 12 years. And that was having a lot of success, and he was getting a lot of signatures, and he was on the path of getting it on the ballot. So the legislature passed a term limit bill, to 12 years.
Where did it go?
And then it was going to go into effect within 12 years. After 12 years, everybody was in the public office then would have to be term limited out. But just before that was going to take effect, they repealed the bill. And so, it's funny to watch these kind of games and how they're played.
The back and forth. Well, there's 2 weeks before the signature gathering deadline, and the sponsors I know of the initiative, the medical marijuana initiative, are getting close to having enough signatures to get on the ballot. And then we'll see what kind of PR campaigns happen, I guess, between them and perhaps the governor.
And they've got some money, too. They've got some money in that campaign. So I'd expect you to see ads in that campaign and in a pretty active campaign for it.
Yeah. That's Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry. We are going to take another quick break here. But when we come back, why some Utahns – actually, no, excuse me. We're going to be talking about a point of difference between the legislature and the governor. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Back in a moment.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more of our in-house podcasts, visit kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Courtney Tanner, and Paul Raleigh. This is our Friday morning news roundup. You can join us with your questions and comments at sltrib.com or at the KCPW Facebook page. Dan Harry, before the break, I mentioned an area of agreement between the governor and the legislature in an objection to citizen initiatives, kind of, or at least the medical marijuana initiative. Let's now look at a point where they are pretty far apart. Governor Herbert vetoed a couple of bills that made it through the legislative session. What did the governor use his veto pen on, Dan, and why?
So we're talking about balance of power. And I think it's actually a continuation of the previous conversation. Before, we were talking about balance of power where citizens have lawmaking authority. And both the governor and legislature agree they don't like that so much. But then there's a different argument, and that's the balance of power between the governor and the legislature. The legislature thinks the governor has too much power in relationship to the legislature and vice versa. So the legislature made it very clear from the opening of the session, Greg Hughes' opening speech, that he wanted to reset that balance, that he wanted to give the legislature some more powers in regard to the executive branch. Mm-hmm. So they passed a couple of bills. One of them was to allow the legislature to represent itself in court when someone challenges state law. And what it appears is the legislature is unhappy with the attorney general's representation and defense of state law and feels like they and their own attorneys could do a better job of that. So they passed that bill to allow themselves to intervene. It has questionable constitutionality, but the legislature doesn't usually let that stop it. And they also appropriated about $700,000 to pay enough for three attorneys, a paralegal, and a legal secretary to actually do this, to intervene in these cases.
Did they have laws, particular laws in mind?
I asked that question of Speaker Greg Hughes, and he said no, it wasn't a particular case. But then he went on to cite a couple of bills that he himself has passed in the past and saw them challenged in court and didn't really like the way that they were represented. He felt like the legislative intent wasn't clearly understood by the Attorney General's office. So It's clear that he had some personal views that the legislature could better represent itself in the court.
Right now, the state of Utah defends laws that are challenged in court, and that broadly means the Attorney General's office, as you said. If this bill remained law without the governor's veto, what would the Attorney General do in those instances when law is challenged and the state through the legislature is representing itself?
Well, the Attorney General still would be the official attorney for the state, and so he would represent the state in those cases. But this would allow the legislature to come in as an intervener and actually put on its own defense. So it wouldn't push the Attorney General out of the way, but it would add the legislature to that court system.
Okay.
The other bill sure. the governor vetoed was one that was directly traceable to last year's fight between the governor and the legislature over legal opinions. The legislature had requested the Attorney General for a legal opinion. Could the governor unilaterally set rules and timetable for the special congressional election?
Right.
And they have every right to do that. There's a state law that says that is one of the Attorney General's duties. He prepared this legal opinion and was just about to deliver it when the red phone from the governor's office rang and he said,
"Metaphor,
you know, don't, yeah. Well, we don't know.
Yeah,
there
don't
may
know.
Be a red phone. We don't know who's on the other end of the line sometimes. But and he said, this would be a conflict of interest. You know, I have attorney-client privilege. You have consulted with my office about the legality of what we're doing. You can't now turn around and give a legal opinion to the legislature that might be different and might undermine my position." And the legislature was furious that the Attorney General wouldn't turn that a legal opinion over. And they ranted and raved, but really didn't do much about it. The Tribune actually sued over this matter. We won the state records committee. They said unanimously, this should be a public record and it should be released. The governor still refused. It went to court. And then after a few months, the governor said, okay, you can release it now. So they did.
Can I ask, you know, now that the governor has vetoed, you know, the legislature, as you said, from the outset, was going to try and carve out more powers for itself. It accomplished that this session with these bills. Now that these vetoes have happened, will the legislature try to override them?
They very well could. They both passed by two-thirds margin. So right now the legislature is in the process of polling their members by phone. If they have sufficient support, they will call. They are allowed in this case to call a special session, go in and do an override vote of those vetoes. There's also one other piece of legislation they passed, which is to allow the legislature to call itself into special session for any emergency, which is not defined. The governor didn't get a chance to veto that because the legislature passes that by two-thirds majorities, and it goes on the November ballot. So the voters will make that decision.
We'll decide whether or not the lawmakers can call themselves into session. for these emergency cases. Paul Raleigh, this is, you know, separation of powers, conversation continued. That's what the governor says that he's trying to preserve here in Utah by making these vetoes. Utah lawmakers have their reasons for this. Since you're a columnist, I'll just ask for your opinion. Were these vetoes the right thing to do, or were they not?
I don't know if they're the right thing to do or not, but there are all sorts of political underpinnings to this whole story. Greg Hughes he's got a very strong personality, and he's probably one of the strongest House speakers we've had in a while, and he's got really good control and good relationships with his members. He's going to run for governor. He's not running for re-election this year. And I mean, everything I've heard points that he's gearing up to run for governor in 2020. Now, Gary Herbert has said that he's not going to run again. He's 71 years old, and you know, I mean, I think it's a good chance he won't, and he'll stick to that. But who knows? I mean, a lot of politicians said they won't run again, and then they do. He's still raising money. And then there's also his lieutenant governor, Spencer Cox, in the mix. And a lot of people think he's if Gary Herbert doesn't run, he'll run against Greg Hughes. Then you got Sean Reyes, the attorney general, who, you know, Dan pointed out has kind of been the target of some of these legislative complaints and everything else. And there's a lot of talk that he may run for governor. And so you've got all these competing political interests.
Is the veto – that was a long introduction there – but is the veto a proxy battle for these political sort of fights?
Well, I think it's a power struggle. And I think that the I think the legislature and Greg Hughes, who I think is, you know, kind of leads the agenda there in a very strong way, believe that the governor's kind of weak on some of these issues. And mm-hmm. and like Dan pointed out, you know, they were outraged that that the attorney general would not release his opinion to the legislature, because the legislature has every right in the world to ask for a legal opinion from the attorney general. And so that kind of triggered all this, you know, infighting and animosity and everything else. Mm.
Guys, we are out of time for the show. Dan, I wanted to squeeze in the story about the governor signing a bill to expand Medicaid in the state if they can get a federal waiver. It'll cover how many people, do we know?
70,000 people.
Okay, 70,000 people. And
it's up in the air whether the feds will approve that. The big sticking point is it's only approving Medicaid for people up to 100% of poverty. And generally, that's been up to 138% is what the federal government's required.
Okay, so a limited expansion needs the waiver, and we will see whether or not the...
And that'll be months away before that decision.
Okay. Guys, it's time now for our underplayed story of the week, and maybe I'll turn to Courtney Tanner, who we haven't heard from in a while. What's your pick for underplayed story, Courtney?
I'm going to highlight a story that Kathy Stevenson wrote about this refugee goat farm.
Yeah.
You should just go check out the pictures because it's smile-worthy.
Okay, check out all the goats at Kathy Stevenson's article. Dan Harry, your pick, underplayed story?
I'm going to repeat my oft-repeated rant against the Utah County Clerk, who cannot seem to do things right. This week, the clerk's office announced that after one election of by-mail voting, they would not do that again. And 2 days later, they reversed course and said they're going to do it. And the commission down there guaranteed an error-free election. So we'll all be watching for that this time.
For the 100% error-free election. That's an interesting one. We'll come back to that at some point, I'm sure. Paul Raleigh, your pick for underplayed story.
Well, we had a story in the paper this morning that longtime Senator Margaret Dayton is not going to run for re-election. And why that's significant is she joins a number of very veteran and high-level, big-player legislators who are not going to run for re-election. Mike Noel, who's kind of led the environmental movement for years and years, is not running for re-election. Howard Stevenson's not running for re-election. He's been in the Senate since the early 90s. And then, of course, the two leaders, Greg Hughes and Wayne Niederhauser, you know, the House and Senate, respectively, they're not running. So there's going to be a major turnaround in the power structure of the Utah legislature next year.
And we'll see who fills those leadership roles as well. We don't know. I mean, we obviously we don't. When will we know that, by the way? way? Who's going to fill House Speaker and Senate?
They have those elections right after the real elections, the November 6th elections.
Okay, so we'll find out at the end of this year who's going to fill those roles. For my pick for underplayed story, I'm going to go with the Chinese space station that is tumbling toward Earth. There's a actually had a conversation yesterday with an astronomer who predicted that it would come down in the next couple of days, Saturday or Sunday. It's supposed to break up in the atmosphere, and I won't say who said this, but the astronomer in question had a number of interesting ideas for where it should land. I'll just leave it up to your imagination.
Are we in danger?
We're not.
That's the question.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not. Utah's Capitol Hill wasn't among the places that he hoped. All right. Paul Rahalli, Dan Harry, and Courtney Tanner, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Roger.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Coming up next on KCPW Presents, it's the latest of the Natural History Museum of Utah lecture series on bio-inspired design. We've got some people to thank for their part in making this show happen. Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, also our partners at Utah Public Radio in Logan, including Tom Williams, Alyssa Roberts, and Spencer Holsey. And many thanks to the show's producer, Emily Means. You can search for Behind the Headlines in your podcast app to find podcasts of this show or go to kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks once again for tuning in, and we will see you next week.